Hello everybody and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola, and though it seems like I'm here solo, I'm actually gonna be joined for the first time on the show by Mara Quint, someone who I've long admired the work of on Twitter. Gonna be joining me today in just a little bit to break down some of the big news of the day, including the political ad policy change on Twitter in response to what's been going on with Facebook. You've got a really interesting new development on the longstanding story of Cambridge Analytica, this time having to do with incels of all things, but very interesting stuff there. And some more developments as well. Later on in the show, let's see, we've got these Democratic fears that Tulsi Gabbard is prepping to run as a third party candidate. I don't share those fears, and so I'm going to describe why that is, why I think that these fears are incredibly overblown at this point. And then meanwhile, in huge new study on sea level rise with some really scary implications for a number of some of the most populated cities literally in the world, as well as a new development on Greta Thunberg that just makes me respect her even more. So that should be a lot of fun too. If you haven't already seen, already up on the YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedamagereport, you can see my initial impressions in a live video I did earlier today on the vote to move forward on the impeachment proceedings. And so take a look at that. There were a couple of Democrats who actually voted against it, and I gave my thoughts on them and what should happen to them. So go to the YouTube channel, you can check that out. But we're gonna be starting off today with a little bit more of a general look at Donald Trump and his presidency on a very important topic that is near and dear not only to him, but also to his base. Let's talk about Donald Trump's slogan. I don't just mean like things that he says a lot, like, you know, lock her up, or stable genius, or Melania, wake up, I'm not done. I mean like formal slogans, campaign stuff. And he's got Make America Great Again, and that's fine. But the one that you're seeing a lot during his reelection effort is actually promises made, promises kept. It's all over the place. Take a look at his social media activity. Promises made, promises kept. And then promises made and promises kept in September. And then promises made and promises kept when he's doing a speech. It's all over the place. But the problem with that is, he's made a lot of promises and he hasn't kept them. And we're not talking about all of them. That's not an analysis. We'll do that at some point. But like, he promised that he'd fix healthcare. In fact, he promised he'd do single payer healthcare, everyone, universal coverage. And he hasn't. He promised he'd enact term limits for Congress. He hasn't even tried to do that. He promised that trade wars are easy to win, discovered they're not. He promised he'd bring back steel and coal, and it's actually doing way worse under him than it was before. He promised that the wall on the border would be built, and it hasn't been, and he especially promised that Mexico would pay for it, and of course it hasn't, and it won't. But as important as those promises that he broke are, there's one that I think is more empirical and more obvious. And if the Republican Party, if the conservative movement, if the Tea Party was serious about the things it says it believes, this would be the cardinal sin. And that has to do with the national deficit and the debt. And it's very clear what he had said he would do on these two areas. In February of 2016, the future president appeared on Fox News and assured viewers that if he were president, he could start paying off the national debt so easily. A month after that, in April 2016, Trump declared that he was confident that he could get rid of the entire multi-trillion dollar debt, quote, fairly quickly. Pressed to be more specific, the future president replied, well, I would say over a period of 8 years. By July 2016, he was boasting that once his economic agenda was in place, quote, we'll start paying off that debt like water. I don't know what that means either, so don't feel bad that that doesn't seem to be an actual expression. It's not, just like he died like a dog. It's not an expression, he just thinks it is because he's a weirdo. But anyway, it was very clear there. National deficit is gonna be gone, national debt, we're gonna pay it off. So we're like 3 years into his presidency now, basically. How is he doing so far? So let's take a look at this promise made and see if it's also a promise kept. Well, the US government's budget deficit ballooned to nearly $1 trillion in 2019, according to the Treasury Department just a few days ago, as the United States fiscal imbalance widened for a fourth consecutive year, despite a sustained run of economic growth. So that's amazing. The deficit grew $205 billion, or 26% in just the last year. The deficit is up nearly 50% in the Trump era. And considering when you actually mark the starting point for that, some say that he's increased it by 68%. So he's moving fast on it, but not necessarily in the right direction, actually. And so let's take a look at how this has worked out year by year. Interesting chart here showing the numbers for that deficit. And you can see you got a little bit of Bush at the beginning, it jumps up during the Great Recession, and then gradually Obama pays down the deficit, gets it lower and lower, and Trump comes in and boom, 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 it's jumping up year by year. Actually, oddly, like it did under George W. Bush. And the weird thing is, they're the party that says that they're fiscally responsible, not like those tax and spend liberals. They are responsible when it comes to the budget, they'll take control of it. That's why you should vote them into office. And yet it always seems to explode when they're in power. It always seems like a Democrat comes into office with huge deficits and then they have to be the responsible ones and then they pay it down, like in the 90s, like under Obama. And then they get voted out just in time for trillions more dollars to be given in tax cuts to the wealthiest people in the history of our species. And then what do you know, it jumps up again. In fact, just as a quick side note, I was doing some analysis of the tax bill that Donald Trump passed, and that's responsible for 20% of the increase in the deficit. So he could have been a lot closer to accomplishing his promise if he had just not made good on his promise behind closed doors to the wealthiest people in America that he would give them untold riches. So that's the deficit blowing up under Donald Trump, despite all of his assurances that that wouldn't happen. What about the debt? Okay, that's something that Republicans have been talking about for decades. It is unsustainable. It is a national security threat to America that our debt is as high as it is, and especially so much of it foreign debt. Well, the US is $3 trillion more in debt than it was when Mr. Trump entered the White House. In those 3 years, it rose 15% from $19.9 trillion to $22.9 trillion. And that really should not be surprising, because when the deficit is going up, that's what makes the debt. I mean, if you got a $1 trillion deficit, I have a prediction for how much higher the debt is gonna be in a year. I think it's gonna be like $1 trillion higher, actually. We'll see, maybe he'll exceed that. But anyway, he has made this big promise and he wants to run on keeping his promises. And this is one of the biggest ones that he has not kept. And you might recall the Tea Party who came into office saying, immediately, as soon as Obama was sworn in, Tea Party rallies were all over the place. And it totally wasn't because he was black. It was totally just because of fiscal responsibility concerns. And they thought that they needed to make a big public show of how important the deficit is, how important the debt is. They elected congressmen and senators all over the place just on that. And yet, where have they been? Where have they been as they've been voting in favor of all of these priorities of Donald Trump that have exploded the deficit and increased the debt over and over and over again? It doesn't look good for them. It doesn't look like they were actually serious about those things. It certainly doesn't look like Donald Trump was serious time after time during the 2016 election when he promised that he would not do what he has now done. But here's the thing, Donald Trump still has one more year definitely as president, unless he's removed, which probably isn't gonna happen. He might even have 5 years. So while this is not a promise kept yet, there is still time. And I'm not saying I have a plan to get rid of the deficit, that I have a plan to get rid of the debt. Donald Trump has a plan. Not a plan that he revealed in 2016, but if you go back to 1999, Trump once proposed clearing the nation's debt at the expense of the rich. You can see a New York Times headline here. This was when he was doing an exploratory committee to run for president at that time. Because another lie was that he's never tried to run for president before, he totally has. But anyway, he said he had a proposal that the government should impose a one-time 14.25% tax on the net worth of individuals and trusts worth $10 million or more. That would raise $5.7 trillion, enough to pay off the national debt in a single year. So, you know, we're talking now about Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, their wealth taxes. Donald Trump had a wealth tax way back in 1999. And the way he saw it, the rich can afford to pay a little bit one time to clear off this debt that we all seem to agree is such a threat to the future of America. Now look, the national debt is higher than it was back in 1999, which means that tax might be have to be a little bit higher. But after all, Donald, it is your idea. And after all, you promised to get rid of this. The solution has been handed to you by past Donald Trump. The only question is whether or not you will actually make good on all those promises from your campaign. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Mark Quint is gonna be joining us. We'll be breaking down the big news of the day after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Facebook's attempt to clarify their policy on why exactly they will allow politicians to lie in political ads, it hasn't worked, and they're all over the place. But Twitter is very clear, actually. It was announced yesterday by Jack Dorsey, the chief executive. He said that political ads, including manipulated videos and the viral spread of misleading information, presented challenges to civic discourse, quote, all at an increasing velocity, sophistication, and overwhelming scale. He said he worried the ads had, quote, significant ramifications that today's democratic infrastructure may not be prepared to handle. And he added that he believed that the reach of political messages should be earned, not bought. And therefore, they will not be allowed. No politicians' ads, no issue-based ads. So it's a pretty wide ban on Twitter. We'll see if this is more popular. And joining us now to discuss is Executive Director for Tax March, Mara Quint. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So what did you think about Jack Dorsey's both the announced policy change and what do you think about the reception to it so far?
I think it's a very interesting thing. Certainly, I think it was unexpected that they would actually take those sort of steps. But I am wary of the broadness of it. When you're saying issue-based, that can be just about anything. And then I'm also really concerned about Twitter's ability to actually enforce this in a real fair way, because we've seen in the past that they haven't really had a lot of, I'll call it luck, in actually doing things fairly and correctly. So I'm very hesitant. I have seen a lot of people thinking that this is a very good thing and being very excited about it. And I can certainly understand the happiness in seeing a media company at least seem to care and want to take some steps, but it's all about how they do it.
And especially for Twitter, which has not seemed to care about most people's concerns about Twitter since the beginning of Twitter, actually. You raised issues about the issue-based ads, and I wonder too, like, if BP buys an ad about how awesome crude oil is, they're not targeting me with that. I'm not going to go buy a big barrel of oil or anything. Like, if there's a documentary about abortion or something, I mean, is that not political too in some respect? And so where do you think it will be? Based on your experience on Twitter, how do you think that this is likely to actually play out in reality?
Well, I don't have the best experiences on Twitter to go off of, so I would be very, very hesitant to see this actually being something that is a net good. Certainly, I think that, you know, there'll be some things pulled and everyone will be really happy not to see some ridiculous GOP video that they want to put out where they've just, you know, created some sort of strange footage that they made up. Like, that'll be nice not to be there. But I also think we're going to see a lot of things where they're yanking issue ads that that perhaps really aren't. And they're leaving other ones where we can definitely argue, okay, this is making a very clear lobbying point and wants to be seen as an issue ad. And it's still up there because it was paid for by a corporation.
You know, I've been watching since the announcement to see, you know, both people I don't tend to agree with politically, but those I do, what do they think about this? Because it's a very different stance than Facebook. And it's been interesting who has come out in support and who's against. There's a lot of progressive voices on Twitter that are saying that this is overbroad, that this would harm campaigns like, for instance, Bernie Sanders, who does a lot of Twitter advertising. That sort of more organic sort of advertising could be hurt. But at the same time, AOC, who really helped to raise the profile of the Facebook side of this issue, she came out in support of Jack Dorsey's plan. She doesn't say it's her ideal plan, but she supports it at the same time that like Hillary Clinton supports it. So it really does seem kind of all over the place at this point.
I think it's because we don't know how it's gonna be played out. So I think that if you're like looking at it from any one particular angle, you can make a case for it or a case against it. And I think it's not gonna be until we start seeing things yanked that we can go, all right, actually, this is something that's good, or this is something that is not working and is actually being used to manipulate what is out there in a different way.
Do you have in mind, like, if you were running one of these corporations, or at least if you had their ear and could advise them, we've now seen Facebook's version of this, we've got Twitter's version of this. In an ideal world, how would this shake out on major social media sites?
Well, I mean, in an ideal world, you just have a lot more more attention and time devoted to oversight of what is being put out there, and there would be very clear rules that could be enforced in a really straightforward way. I mean, the FCC, for instance, mm-hmm. people know exactly where the lines are, and it's usually pretty immediately enforced. They're not perfect, but at least right now we do have some sort of model to see that it can be done. You can actually kind of have some control over what is going out and what's not. So I think that they would need to put a lot more resources into it in general, and then actually start acting upon it. I mean, certainly, there's been quite a demand on Twitter for the Nazis to be rid for some time, and they don't really seem to be doing much about that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are other places they could start as well.
Yeah, maybe if the Nazis start doing more paid advertisement, then they'll finally suffer some strike back. But until then, they seem to be doing okay on social media. Okay, yeah. Let's switch it up to another topic. In the Democratic primary so far, I would say, based on my experience, it's been fairly clear of the high profile candidates directly going after each other. I mean, you've had people like, you know, Tim Ryan will launch some bombs or somebody like that back when he was in the race. But the top three, Biden, Warren, and Bernie, generally haven't criticized each other all too much, especially off the debate stage on substantive policy based grounds. And yet that might be changing because Joe Biden's campaign has launched an attack against Bernie Sanders on his Medicare for All plan, with one of his surrogates saying, his deputy campaign manager, Kate Bedingfield, who said in a statement, "It's alarming that Senator Sanders, who has been upfront for years that Medicare for All would require middle class tax hikes, won't tell voters right now how much more they will pay in taxes because of his plan. When you're running to take on the most dishonest president in American history, Senator Sanders and others who back Medicare for All have to preserve their credibility." So what do you think about the substance of this attack against Bernie? And also, do you think that we might be entering a more combative phase of this primary?
Yeah, I definitely think that we're at the start of that. I mean, we are now coming to the end of the year. We are going to have our Iowa caucuses right around the corner. So this is when, you know, things are going to step up. I think it's a good sign for Bernie that Biden has chosen him to go after. And I can understand why Biden would want to start launching attack ads at this point. I mean, he's been dropping for some time. His polling is not going well, so he's got to be start doing something a little bit more extreme or radical to kind of get more attention and to start taking some shots and hopefully, you know, hoping that that will help boost him.
You know, on the debate stage, transparency, I support Bernie Sanders in the primary. He generally does not attack other candidates on the debate stage. He will respond if someone attacks him on the stage. And I wonder if, like, he's been pretty light on Biden, I would say, overall. I wonder if this might make the Bernie side, the Bernie campaign, feel a little bit freed up to go after Biden, since they plausibly will not be seen as being the one who threw the first blow, maybe?
Sure, possibly. I mean, you know, obviously that's what's set up now, but I kind of think one of the reasons that we haven't really seen Bernie be so aggressive towards other candidates on stage is because of his overarching message. I mean, he has really been very clear on the not me, us wording that they're using. And so what I've noticed from watching these debates a little too intently is that he tends to pull the focus back onto what he sees as his vision and what he wants to do much more than actually just trying to go after other candidates. He's really, it seems, trying to win over the hearts and minds of the people watching based on what he wants the policies to be.
Yeah.
I think that would probably keep going.
And we should probably also bear in mind that the substance of attack matters, but also the media reaction matters. I mean, we had two debates where in one, Julian Castro was very aggressive and he was described immediately as being angry. And Pete Buttigieg was very aggressive in the next one. He was described as strong, you know, and he was like pushing for his position. So depending on who it is, the media can sometimes react a little bit differently about people sort of being assertive in pushing for their agenda.
Are you saying that the media covers people differently from one another?
I'm hinting at it.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if Bernie does. Mara, stick with us for just one break. We're gonna come back, a couple more topics to talk about. We'll be back in just a few. The story of Cambridge Analytica and their activities during the 2016 election on using social media to try to manipulate people psychographically into supporting one sort of politician and not others is a fascinating story with a new twist that I did not see coming. And this comes courtesy of one of the whistleblowers from inside Cambridge Analytica. At a talk at the Emanuel Center in London on Monday, Christopher Wiley said that Steve Bannon viewed incels as easy victims for manipulation as they were, quote, lacking economic opportunities and were more prone to, quote, conspiratorial thinking. He said that can make an impact. If you get an extra 1%, an extra 2% in that swing state and you win that swing state, that might mean you win the presidency. So Mark Quint joining us once again. I've heard a lot of explanations as to why the presidency went to Donald Trump. I haven't heard it placed on the backs of incels yet.
It's kind of surprising that you haven't heard it placed on the back of incels yet, really. I mean, we were going to get there eventually. So, yeah. You know, this is not so much a surprise. I think it makes, you know, a lot of sense, given that what the Trump presidency was selling was telling you that there's somebody else who's responsible for your problems in a very direct way. I mean, they were really running on sort of a message of hate. And fundamentally, that's what you're looking at when you're looking at someone who identifies as an incel. They're somebody who is looking for an outside source to blame, and specifically an outside group to blame for what they perceive as some unfairness done to them. So, you know, it's hand in hand. I mean, it makes sense. They should be there, probably their target market.
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. The Republican Party isn't necessarily sophisticated in many different ways, but one of the ways that they are sophisticated is they've been able to identify these seemingly disparate groups, all of whom are incredibly frustrated about something in their life, and then they all lash out at the wrong people, people who aren't actually causing it. So the incels hate women, and you know, people who are related to incels, the pickup artist communities and all that, the men going their own way, the red pill and all that. You have the people who think that it's all about race. You have the Islamophobes and all of that. They all think that someone who is different than them demographically or psychographically is responsible for this. And somehow all of those groups have been sort of shepherded into the right wing, into supporting tax cuts for billionaires and, you know, banning Muslims from coming into the US.
Yeah, they've done a fantastic job. I mean, their primary goal has always really been very economic and very, how can we give the wealthy more money? And so being able to manipulate people on this sort of societal level and then push them to just sort of take whole package these economic worldviews has been pretty impressive, definitely. And certainly in the reverse, it's something that the Democratic Party has really failed to do. Mm-hmm. They've failed to bring people together. And I think a lot of that is because one of the things that counters that and brings people together is some sort of hope, is bringing people together for a common good, and the Dems tend to splinter on any sort of messaging when it comes to that sort of thing.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. I don't want to see, like, you know, the DNC getting more savvy at like enraging people towards different outgroups or anything. but it does seem like for seemingly millions of Americans, messages of like basically organizing around a 2-minute hate versus different groups certainly seems more appealing than a message of, you know, raising the minimum wage or these other sort of societal goods that could actually improve the conditions of these incels and things like that. Are you worried that a political strategy might run up against like sort of inherent psychological flaws in humanity that we are small-minded people that tend to be like we have dark passions, we're prejudiced and all of that?
I mean, we are, right? We all have that capacity for anger and hatred. And, you know, I mean, not to be too Star Warsy, but it's very easy to give in to that sort of hate and it's very easy to appeal to it.
Hold it really fast, Mara. Feel free to be as Star Warsy as you want on this show.
Good to know. Good to know. Okay. I'll start whipping out all the Star Wars references. But yeah, I think that's a really easy thing to do. It's very, you can walk up to someone and make them hate somebody else pretty quickly, really. You just have to know how to say it. And I think that the problem is the Dems have just, they don't really want to do that, which, hey, that's good. But they don't know what else to do. And I think that we also, all of us share two other traits that we should be tapping into. One is that everybody wants just a nice life. Everybody wants to be, you know, not be worried about where they're going to get food and have a place to live and generally exist in some sort of societal structure that isn't just sort of stepping on their backs all the time. So, I mean, that's one thing we all also want. Mm-hmm. And additionally, given the state of things right now, we are, most of us, pretty angry. And anger doesn't always mean hate. You know, it can be. You can take that anger and you can push it towards hate, but you can take that anger and you can push it elsewhere as well. Anger is a very powerful force. And I think that if we can really learn to organize around anger, I think we can really sort of get somewhere because, you know, anger is what is keeping us kind of where we are at the status quo. We can also use that, say, no, I want something more and I'm angry and I'm going to be angry until we all collectively get something more.
Okay, I like that. And I think that there's very different approaches amongst the Democrats who are vying for, you know, to win this primary. Some of them, I think, are well positioned to use that anger to accomplish, I would say, far better goals. But let's turn to one last topic, and that's the news around Katie Hill. So Katie Hill announced her resignation in the wake of the seemingly well-coordinated campaign against her. She said that she would be stepping down. And I think some people see it as justice. It's, you know, the same standard being applied to all sorts of people. But I think a lot of people have a bad taste left in their mouth by this experience. I read a quote by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently, who said, "I don't think we're really talking about how targeted and serious this is. We're talking about a major crime being committed against her." And she said, "Of course, the incident will intimidate other women thinking of launching their own campaigns." And so I tweeted yesterday, and a lot of people responded to it. Can she like reverse a resignation when it turns out that like one of the people breaking the story had worked for the campaign against her? It feels dirty in a lot of different ways.
It is dirty. It's incredibly dirty. I mean, you know, we've seen plenty of elected representatives long before her who have engaged in far worse behavior, and some of them are still in office. You know, I was kind of like looking in to see who else was there, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he's from Tennessee, Scott DeJarlie. He is currently in office. He had affairs not just with staffers, but with patients when he was a physician. He's strong pro-life, and he forced his ex-wife to get abortions. I mean, that is somebody who's still currently in office.
Yeah.
So obviously, we know that this is not always the outcome. Representatives are not always forced to resign. And as AOC said, there is actually a crime being perpetrated against Katie. So, you know, it's kind of even worse. The only difficulty or hesitation I would say is that it is very hard to be in the public view in general. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly hard to be a woman in the public space. And I would love for Katie Hill really to reverse her resignation, but I also would never ask or expect her to, because fundamentally, it's about what she has to do for her, ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, and it's unfortunately, she's going through something terrible, regardless of whether or not she was serving or otherwise. So, you know, I would be most concerned for her own mental health at this point.
Yeah, yeah, and as you point out, it's not like it's over, it continues. And she's gotta be worried about other stuff that could be released or used against her or members of her family. As you say, you know, it's hard to be a woman in the public eye. It's also obviously harder to be a woman in the public eye. And these standards that are being set up, either ethics standards for members of Congress or sort of societal expectations around certain things, we might like to think that they'll be applied evenly between men and women in public office and things like that, but they obviously won't be. There's good and bad ways, I think, to communicate around that. Nancy Pelosi recently said that this shows that young people need to be careful, which feels a little bit to me like victim blaming there. But I know a lot of other people have been saying, like, especially the revenge porn and things like that, using nude photos against people, that is not going to be used evenly against men and women, obviously. And so I feel like regardless of where people come out on Katie Hill, we need to start to think seriously about what's gonna happen next year in 10 years as there are more and more of these sorts of photos and more digital information available that can be used to destroy people unequally.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we also generally are still very puritanical in a lot of our mindsets as a country. And we definitely have a hard time still with women being sexual at all, especially if they're owning their own sexuality, which what we've seen from Katie is that she was somebody who did and does. And that alone is like terrifying, I think, to a lot of the population. And fundamentally, we have to change our attitudes on that. And I think we will. I hope to see us do so, because we are going to be seeing more and more people in positions of power who have a lot more of a digital footprint. It's just going to happen. So I think that probably our mindsets will change. I wish there was a way to speed it up and get us there quickly, but I don't know how that is, how that would be.
I don't know either. And I would love that on a lot of different areas. Marquin, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, lots of concerns in the press about Representative Tulsi Gabbard running as a third party candidate. I don't share those concerns, and I have a video clip that I think will demonstrate why I don't share them after this. Over the past week or so, you've probably seen all over the internet a new wave of hot takes about Representative Tulsi Gabbard and her presidential ambitions. And they all have a common thread: fear amongst people who don't support Tulsi Gabbard that she will in fact run as a third party candidate. And I just don't see it, which I hope to explain why in this video. But I want to give you an example of what form these come in. So take a look at this. You'll see a long video, an interview getting into it with a panel about how Hillary Clinton suggests that Tulsi Gabbard's being groomed as a third party candidate, which was news for like a week or two. You've got, you know, on the Hill, Gabbard stokes fear among Democrats. And it's really all over the place. This concern that we're gonna take a look and a particular statement or a particular tweet or a particular action or a particular way of campaigning, all of it secretly means that although she says she's serious about running as a Democrat, she in fact is just going to run as a third party candidate. And what might that do to the 2020 election? And I don't share those concerns because I've looked at the actual evidence and she has been incredibly clear about third party candidacies. And so let's take a look at something. This is just back at the end of August, just a little bit ago. Here she is.
Earlier this month, you told our political reporter, Caitlin Huey Burns, that you would support the Democratic nominee if you end up not winning the primary. Is there any policy a Democratic nominee could hold that would persuade you not to endorse them in the general election?
No, I am, as are all of the other candidates that I'm aware of running for president, committed to defeating Donald Trump in 2020. I look forward and hope to be able to earn that nomination myself, but if not, then I'll join with others in making sure that that happens.
So that video is just like a month and a half old, and it is incredibly clear, unambiguous. And by the way, the question wasn't just, will you support the eventual Democratic nominee if you're not the nominee? It was, is there anything that this nominee could do that would cause you not to? And she said, no, like all of them, I will support whoever it is if it's not me. That's unambiguous. And it's not just in that video. She was on a podcast. This is just, I think, in the last week. She was on the Angry Americans with Paul Rieckhoff podcast and asked about this. She said, I will not run as a third party candidate. No, my interest and goal is not to just leave the party and run separately. As I've said, my goal is to actually strengthen the party. And I would say that that might actually be literally the most progressive thing about Tulsi Gabbard, is this belief that we don't simply leave the party if we don't like what it currently looks like. We make it better from inside. That is why when I say the name Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know who that is. Because although she had a lot of issues with the Democratic Party and continues to this day, she ran in a Democratic primary and won. And now she's changing the party from the inside out. If she'd run as a third party candidate against Joe Crowley, she would have lost and you wouldn't know who she is. And Tulsi Gabbard is following that same strategy, the AOC, the Bernie Sanders strategy of changing the party from within. So look, these are not the only times that she has responded to questions about running as a third party candidate incredibly unambiguously and said that she wouldn't. There are others, but this is enough. And I know what some of you are saying, but she's not running for re-election in the House, and that's really suspicious. And I get what you're saying, but there are other explanations why she might not run for re-election. And I know you might be thinking, well, okay, yes, those quotes are unambiguous, but she could still change her mind. And yes, technically that could happen. And considering how unambiguous she's been year after year on this topic, if she were to change her mind and run as a third party candidate, that she would have no credibility whatsoever. Every actual progressive would have it on them to denounce her because she has been so clear about what would actually be accomplished by her running as a third party candidate. But she's not doing that. And so these fears really seem misplaced. And the thing is, it's not a new thing. Like, I don't know why you're not supposed to talk about the 2016 election and how progressives voted in that way. Like, you're supposed to pretend that they didn't, but you might remember 2016, Bernie Sanders campaigned for Hillary Clinton after the primary was over. Okay, he gets attacked for not doing that. He did. And Tulsi Gabbard also supported Hillary Clinton in the general election. Here she is talking about this in August 2016. Given the remaining choices, like Bernie Sanders, I will be casting my vote for Hillary Clinton. Because she didn't want Donald Trump to become president, and she knew that voting in any other way does not lower the chance that Donald Trump becomes president. And so, look, people like to think that's an inconvenient truth. You're not supposed to acknowledge that. But she was loyal to her party in 2016. There is no reason to believe that she will not be now. And look, honestly, let's say you were to discount all of this. Let's say, let's not listen to what she said. Let's not look at what she's done. But what if she did anyway? What if she ran? The fear, of course, is founded in a belief that it would increase the chance that Donald Trump gets reelected. But honestly, I don't even think that that's necessarily proven. First of all, third party candidate support is more complex than most people seem to think. A ballot access expert, Richard Winger, said, these people who throw around spoiler are ignorant of the research that contradicts their thinking. It just drives me crazy. There's all this sophisticated psychological research and historical data that gets ignored. And people just assume that a Green Party candidate or somebody like that hurts Democrats automatically. And it's just not that clear. It's not clear at all that people who support a third party candidate would, in the absence of that candidate, vote some other way or indeed vote at all. And you can look into that research too. And even if your concerns are specific to Tulsi Gabbard, who again has said that she wouldn't do this, if she did, if you actually go into the crosstabs, for instance, I looked at a recent survey that just came out in the last couple of days where she was doing a little bit better in the Democratic primary than previously. If you look at her favorability, for instance, broken down into different groups, what you see there doesn't imply that she would draw a ton of focus away from the Democratic nominee. It actually implies that it might go the opposite way. Her favorability rating in the primary amongst people who support her is more than twice as high for self-described Republicans than Democrats. It's more than twice as high for self-described conservatives as liberals. And so if she were to actually run, which again, she says that she won't, it might be that it's a bit of a wash or could even hurt Donald Trump in some areas, that disaffected Republicans who like Tulsi Gabbard on one or another of issues, perhaps foreign policy, which is her hallmark issue, might actually choose to support her rather than supporting the Republican nominee. So look, best case scenario for people who are really worried about this is that it's a complicated issue, but far more likely she's been incredibly clear about what she actually plans to do if she doesn't get the nomination. And so I think that we can at least wait and see and not hyperventilate in the lead up to that. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back meanwhile in news from around the world. And now news from around the world, and meanwhile in Meanwhile, in Germany, a Nobel Peace Prize winner is calling for ISIS fighters to be tried like the Nazis were in public to make clear what it is exactly that they've done. You might recall that tragically, ISIS fighters seized villages in Sinjar in Iraq back in 2014, slaughtering a number of Yazidi men and boys before abducting women and girls to be used as sex slaves. Nadia Murad was kidnapped from the village of Kocho in Sinjar and held by ISIS for 3 months before she managed to escape. Now she lives in Germany and she's the founder of Nadia's Initiative, an organization dedicated to, quote, rebuilding communities in crisis and advocating for survivors of sexual violence. For her efforts and the experience that she underwent, back in 2018, she won the Nobel Peace Prize for fighting to end efforts to use sexual violence as a weapon of war. And now with the profile that she has, she's advocating for a change in how ISIS fighters are eventually tried, saying, "The death of al-Baghdadi is welcoming news for the world, especially for those communities that were targeted by ISIS. Baghdadi died as he lived, a coward using children as a shield. Let today be the beginning of a global fight to bring ISIS to justice." So very clearly a beginning, not an end. "Those captured alive need to be brought to justice in an open court for the world to see. Justice is the only acceptable course of action. We must unite and hold ISIS terrorists accountable in the same way the world tried the Nazis in an open court at the Nuremberg trials." And so that is obviously a fascinating idea. I have not heard of that actually being pursued right now, but there is something to it, especially considering the nature of ISIS. ISIS is unlike other terror groups in that their goal was never to simply exist in the shadows and then strike out against their ideological opponents. They had a goal. It was a geographic governmental goal. They sought to create their own caliphate and to rule. And so, similar to in other cases where regimes were run by war criminals and people who had committed massive human rights assaults, why not try them before the entire world? Why not make clear what it is that they did? And don't allow people who might share some sort of strategic or tactical affiliation with ISIS to actually hide from the horrible human rights atrocities that they were responsible for. It certainly worked with the Nazis. Maybe something like it could work in this case as well. And thank you to Nadia Murad for continuing to advocate for justice in every area that she can. Meanwhile, in Sweden, Greta Thunberg has been awarded an environmental award with a cash prize for her efforts. And in response, she has said, "No, I don't want it." And she explained why. She said, "I have received the Nordic Council's environmental award in 2019. I've decided to decline this prize. Here's why. The climate movement does not need any more awards. What we need is for our politicians and the people in power to start to listen to the current best available science. The Nordic countries have a great reputation around the world when it comes to climate and environmental issues. There's no lack of bragging about this. There's no lack of beautiful words. But when it comes to our actual emissions and our ecological footprints per capita, if we include our consumption, our imports, as well as aviation and shipping, then it's a whole other story. So until you start to act in accordance with what the science says is needed to limit the global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees or even 2 degrees Celsius, I and Fridays for Future in Sweden choose not to accept the Nordic Council's environmental award, nor the prize money of 500,000 Swedish kronor. Best wishes, Greta Thunberg." That's strong. I mean, especially considering it's money. But her response showed not only like sort of like courage and integrity, but also, again, a sophistication of the material that she's advocating for beyond what most adults would be able to manage. So great job there in Greta for both when you're being attacked, but even when you're being lauded for sticking to your principles there. Meanwhile, in the oceans, they are arising and apparently rising worse than we thought. A new study shows that more than 3 times as many people are in direct peril from rising oceans than previously considered. Take a look at a comparison with the old data and the new data. Here is Vietnam, where 20 million people live. You can see that it was always going to be bad for them as the oceans rose, but in the end, there is not going to be much of the entire country left once the oceans are done. Heading over to Bangkok, you can see a very similar story. It was going to be bad. It is going to be devastating by 2050. On to Shanghai, where obviously many, many people live. Let's jump to Shanghai here. You can see that area, again, will be decimated. Best case scenario, it becomes an archipelago, effectively, where millions and millions of people will have to flee ahead of the changes. In Mumbai, too, another heavily populated area, It didn't look too bad, except for the outlying areas, but where Mumbai now stands, an ocean will soon stand. This is devastating. And by the way, even this, as is always the case, it's kind of an understatement, because they're not even factoring for population growth between now and 2015 or coastal erosion. This is simply changing ocean levels. So as bad as that looks, it's gonna be worse. And I've looked here in the US as well. New Orleans is going to be gone. Miami is going to be devastated. All of this is going to happen, and it is going to cause utter chaos. Let's try to limit it to utter chaos and not move beyond that to an actual apocalypse. Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately, today. Thank you so much for watching. We've only got one more day of the week, but I hear Brett Ehrlich is gonna be on. Some people think he's quite a fun guy. So tune in tomorrow, he'll be joining me there. And thank you for watching, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.